Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Paul with us joining us again. Thank you so much, Paul, for your contributions and taking the time out of your schedule to be a part of this. If we could only get, a body of people to start definitizing the Constitution, that would be great. But let's just plow forward here. And what I wanted to do as we were kind of ending up last week is, I wanted to create a summation on the powers of, the powers that were delegated in Article 1, Section 8. And so when you look at the preamble being the top, not being a power, the first power that was actually provided to the Congress or the federal government was to borrow money. The next one was to regulate commerce, blah. The third one, establish a uniform rule of naturalization bankruptcy. The fourth was coining money. The fifth was the providing for punishment of counterfeiting. So this was the first crime. The next one was to establish the post offices and post roads. So the seventh was to promote science by creating, patents and copyrights. The eighth one was to create inferior courts. The ninth was to define the punishment, so another crime of piracies and felonies on the high seas and offenses against the laws of nations. So when we get to the 10th, out of the total of, 17, I think? Out of the total of 17, The first nine are really kind of administrative stuff, and the rest kind of has a lot to do with the military and defense and national security. So out of, when you really look at the real focus of the federal government, its focus was to kind of create a stability and a national security, because, we can't be a secure nation if we don't have a secure currency.
Right.
And, we can't be a secure nation if we're, in debt all over the place. And so, in ways, even the first nine were kind of for national security, national interests. So then 10 is the declaration of war. The 9 is to raise and support armies. 12 is to provide for the Navy. 13 is to make rules for governing these forces. 14, to call forth a militia to execute the laws of the Union, blah, blah, blah. And 15 is where we really left off. So this is the sixth power mentioned in Article 1, Section 8, regarding the defense and national security. Specific national security. So to providing for the organizing of the army and disciplining the militia and governing them as part may be employed in the service of the United States, reserving to the states respectively the appointment of the officers and the authority of training the militia according to the discipline prescribed by Congress. So that kind of, we have this large amount of power over national security.
Mm-hmm.
I want to emphasize this, folks, that this is the one thing. A lot of people have a problem with the wars, and we shouldn't be fighting wars we have no business to be involved in. And the reason we get involved is because our foreign policy is not governed by what's best for America. Our foreign policy has been basically, I'll just say, seized and controlled by the globalists. They're the ones that are forming our foreign policy, and they've been manipulating the world by using America. This is where I think I've mentioned some amendments, right? At least I think I've mentioned one. I honestly think that, and I'd have to go back through because there's a few in my head, but this is one right here where I honestly believe, I think it's the... we were talking about the Congress and the legislature and having the states actually having the control and being able to, pull back and actually punish our public servants and so forth, because they protect themselves. they don't want to be held accountable. But in this case, in this amendment, I honestly believe that America would be far better off if the states actually, and this goes to the Senate and the importance of the equal suffrage of the states in the Senate, we should actually be pushing a very specific, you know, foreign policy that would actually bring nations into the Constitution instead of fighting wars.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that the states should be driving what is in our interest in foreign policy instead of allowing these puppets for the globalists who sit in the White House. I believe that as you distribute the ability to representation, this goes back to like the Supreme Court. We've talked about, you know, revising the Supreme Court to having a justice for each state.
Mm-hmm.
So that each state has representation in the Supreme Court. And that way you actually can create, and you can actually allow the Supreme Court to, you know, work off its workload to be able to do those things that are really pertaining, arising under the Constitution, and make the Supreme Court more of a, you know, not as a stressful job or the work, because they complain about the workload. They say they can't do all of these things. Most of those things they shouldn't even be doing in the first place. But nevertheless, I honestly believe that each state should have representation in the Supreme Court, and that the Chief Justice is the only one that's actually appointed, or Assistant Chief Justice, to make sure that the tie-breaking can be done, you know, so that the, you know, we don't get caught in a stranglehold where it's even.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so nevertheless, in this particular case, you know, it is my opinion that the states should be driving the foreign policy in ensuring that we're not getting engaged in a war, when what we should be doing is actually saying, you know what, Ukraine, if you want to be free and unfettered from Russia, you need to become a state in the United States, period.
Wow. That would set off some...
Absolutely.
That would set off some fireballs.
Absolutely. And, oh, by the way, here are the things you have to do. All of these chemical warfare, biological warfare labs, all of these things that you're doing, you're going to, you know, you got to shut those things down. You've got to assume our laws, take on our language, these types of things. But we shouldn't be involved in people fighting a war. We shouldn't be involved in fighting a war for another person just because their enemy happens to be Russia.
Right.
The reason we should be fighting a war is because these people want individual liberty and individual sovereignty, and they want to enjoy the benefits of being a part of the union. If they want to actually be out there to play the manipulative game, because, you know, these conquesting nations, you know, the progressives talk about, you know, the conquest and the colonization of the world and how America is still colonizing. Actually, the colonization is being done by Russia and China and America. All, you know, it is the trifecta. There's these brokers that are out trying to get alliances and those types of things, even though they're not actually well, China is creating colonies and Russia is the same, but we're creating colonies of political alliance and so forth. But the reality is that we shouldn't be creating colonies. We should be growing the union.
Right.
Because creating a sovereign state is different than creating a nation that is subjugated to us, like going into Somalia and making them dependent on feeding them. That should never have happened.
Wow.
That should never have happened. We should have actually said, hey, you want to become a state in the union, we'd be happy to. Then we can actually, you know, help.
Sure. Or Taiwan.
Right. And specifically Taiwan, Hong Kong. Yeah, the best defense is a great offense, and there's no better offense than offering liberty to the world.
Right.
Anyway, so the next power is 16, to exercise exclusive legislation. So technically, even though this starts off with that line, this is still a national security power.
Mm-hmm.
because it identifies the property that the federal government can operate. And if you look at the property, the reason for that property is for military national security purposes. So let me get into this. Actually, I'll let you go ahead and read this because I've been reading.
Okay. 16, right? To exercise exclusive legislation, in all cases whatsoever over such district not exceeding 10 miles square as may, by cession of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be, for the election of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings.
Okay, so when you look at the properties that are identified there, they're all to basically allow the federal government to provide a level of security. So when we look at the going into the territories, they needed to have forts. They needed to have these arsenals, for security purposes as we were expanding. And then eventually, once a territory came online, the cavalry and all of those people that were assigned to that state, right, as we were expanding westward, when Missouri became a state, then the cavalry would no longer be able to function in there. They may have forts and so forth, but the responsibility of the internal security should have gone to the militia of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And had they done that, that would have actually supported the principles of what we were talking about in developing a very strong militia system.
Right.
And so none of these properties is really for anything other than for security or for external controls. I'll give you a good one. Needful buildings. Well, okay, so in D.C. they have needful buildings, but what needful building would they have in California?
Probably the post office.
Well, okay, so the post office, but the other needful building would be for importation of goods, for commerce coming in. They have the responsibility of inspecting and making sure that they're collecting the imposts on those goods coming in.
Right.
And it would be the same thing at an airport. When all of a sudden people are coming in from foreign nations, if it's an international airport, then they need to have a needful building for the inspection and customs and controls.
Right. Correct.
But that's about it, folks. That's about it. They don't need to have, you know, outhouses in the forest and, you know, these little campsites and hookups for RVs. That's not the federal government's job. That's not something that's enumerated here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the last one, go ahead and read the last one.
To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof.
Okay, so I'm going to actually, you know, I highlighted in this because this is how it gets violated. To make all laws which shall be necessary and proper. When they say that and they create the law, then they have failed to qualify that law. The qualifier is in the next part of that same sentence. There's not even a comma there.
Right.
Right. They end right there to make all laws necessary and proper. Like there is a comma, but there's not. The rest of the sentence says this, for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. So the only laws that they can create for the union, and so it's interesting that this follows this carte blanche power that they have to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such district, not exceeding 10, you know, so in other words, the ability to create their own laws for the District of Columbia and territories. And for territories, it is only for the purpose of transitioning or admitting that territory into the Union.
Right.
And so when we look at this right here, that they can, the only laws that are applicable to states are when they are applying to the foregoing powers. which it synchronizes with the supremacy clause that basically says all laws made under their authority in pursuance to the Constitution. And so, and we'll get into that. That's Article 6. But
so real quick, before we get away from the one above it, let me ask you a question. Doesn't their exclusive legislation, all cases whatsoever over the district, doesn't that kind of make them the city council of the District of Columbia?
Yeah. They are the governing body over all the policing. That was covered in the ratification debates. The reason they had that was so that they would be in charge of the policing and the laws for the district.
Then why do they need a mayor?
They don't. They didn't. It's called bureaucracy. In other words, because Congress, you know, puffed themselves up and, well, we're too important to have to worry about the governing. What they actually had to do to create a mayor and city council for the District of Columbia and basically that governing body, all of that governing body that they created, for them to actually do that, they would have to actually amend the Constitution to take away that exclusive legislation. And that have it basically changed to establishing a municipal, you know, government.
Sure.
And that's it. And then giving them the power over them, because that's how it would be. But they felt that no. You can't hold them accountable for the powers that they're executing and so forth. So anyway.
Okay.
All right. So now we're getting into Section 9. What's unique about Section 9?
Section 9, I mean, this has to do with slavery, and particularly, well, let's see, Section 9 is more than slavery. It starts out with that.
Yeah.
It is.
But there's a unique tone to Section 9. There's a very unique tone to Section 9.
These are prohibitions.
Yes, these are restrictions placed on the government itself, on the federal government. Section 10 is a unique group or a unique section because it's restrictions placed upon the states.
Correct.
So the 10th Amendment talks about powers not delegated or restrictions. And so when you look at, or because it talks about the Constitution actually restricting states from being able to do certain things. So that's why they include the state's restrictions, that powers not delegated to the federal government or restricted to the states, you know, are left to the states, respectively, and to the people. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So go ahead, because the very first part, you're absolutely right. The first part is dealing with slavery.
Okay.
And so
you want me to read the first part right
yeah,
now?
Yeah, let's just read the first paragraph, right.
All right. The migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit shall not be prohibited by the Congress prior to the year 1808. But a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation not exceeding $10 for each person.
Yeah, and the southern states did not like that taxation that they placed on slaves.
Mm-hmm. There is. I listened to a video recently, which claims that this is one of the abuses of the Constitution, that they admitted the importation of slaves and allowed it to go on for 20 years.
Repeat that.
Okay. I saw a video just a couple.
Yeah. Okay. You saw this in a video, this, right?
But, and it said, right. And it's, they were speaking of the Constitution in a sense disparagingly in that, you know, this was one of those, this, how should I say, slave promoting document, prohibited the abolition of slavery and allowed it to go on for 20 years. Right?
So So here's the question.
Right.
Does the federal government have the authority to dictate, you know, how a state can conduct its own labor?
Actually, no.
No. So at this point in time, it wasn't promoting slavery. It was allowing the continuance of slavery that was being conducted in the states. So it all depends on how you want to start editorializing what you're looking at. Mm-hmm. In other words, did the Constitution establish slavery, and when it was ratified, slavery began?
No, as a matter of fact, if it were up to some of the other states, they might have allowed the slaveholding states to walk away. They didn't do that. So there were far more states against slavery. But as it turned out, we found a way to include all 13 states in the Union, because probably for our protection against Britain, we were all united against that problem. Right?
Okay, so what you saw, that video, is an editorializing of stupidity. In other words, it gets people who can't think for themselves to take, you know, somebody's assessment to say that the Constitution is this racist document when it's not.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I mean, it's almost like saying, you know, that all people with blonde hair have, you know, a low IQ.
Okay.
Right? I mean, it's creating a generalization and actually trying to create a persona or a stereotype that the Constitution was established as a racist document. And that has got to be one of the most ignorant comments anybody could say. Because if you don't understand the history of why these things were inserted, then you have no clue that there were out of the 12, because Rhode Island wasn't there.
All right.
So okay. Out of the 12, 9 states wanted to abolish. Let's keep in mind, Virginia, which was a slave state, Maryland, which was a slave state, these states' representatives at the Constitutional Convention said, we're going to abolish slavery. Now, maybe it was divine providence that these 3 states basically injected that, you know, you can't do this. And because at this point in time, I honestly don't think that the people, because we saw this in Virginia and possibly a couple of the other states that actually, you know, said, hey, you know, they're trying to get rid of slavery. You know, this is how we make our money. And my point is that sometimes, you know, you can't rush into something because it may cause a problem. Was America ready to end slavery? Not 9 of the state's delegates were. But when we read the Virginia, you know, portion, and that included Kentucky, and we start looking at, you know, the other states, this actually helped prepare America for ending slavery. Because we know that. In reading the Pennsylvania, the Massachusetts, and I forget there was another one. There was 3 of the documents of the ratification debates. And we identified that they were talking about, you know, that these compromises were designed to actually allow slavery to be phased out. So we're going into break right now. So we will have to bring this back up because I want to talk about that, because I truly believe, folks, that there is a plethora of misinformation, and it's all basically designed to play on the heartstrings of good people that are ignorant regarding the truth or the real history behind all of this stuff. Anyway, we'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as you were just saying, and actually, when we hear people make these, you know, flat out assertions that, you know, the Constitution's this, that, or the other thing, then, and they do it based on ignorance, then, you know, how do they defend themselves when they actually realize, you know, that there were only three states that really needed to do this, but the framers actually put, they were moved to say the union was far more important to maintain than allow these three states. Now, you've heard me say, as an armchair quarterback, you've probably heard me say this, that I think that the nine states should have allowed those three states to go. I believe what would have ended up happening is I believe that Virginia would have gone too.
Really?
Yes, because they were, when you go through the ratification debates, they did not like the idea of giving up their slaves.
Okay, so they were inclined.
The five delegates, forgive me for interrupting you. The five delegates at the convention, Mason, an abolitionist. Madison, an abolitionist. Washington, I mean, we kind of knew that he had slaves, but he didn't like slavery. I mean, every person there representing Virginia did not like slavery, and they thought it would have been a good idea to push this issue. Mm-hmm. But I truly believe that Virginia would have rejected the Constitution and probably would have actually created a division between the northern states and the southern states at that point in time. Because we already saw in the southern states them saying, hey, the northern states are getting rid of all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
What you're saying is that had Virginia gone that way, the Constitution might not have happened.
That's correct.
Wow.
That's correct because, well, we knew North Carolina, Rhode Island wouldn't have, and then South Carolina and Virginia, that would have been 5 out of 13. And
you wouldn't have had
the 9, right? Yep.
Right.
Right.
Wow.
And who knows about Maryland? I mean, Maryland was a slave state as well, but they rubber stamped it because of its suffrage and protection that the Constitution gave them. So mm-hmm. they didn't really debate it at all. And I think Maryland would have been another state that would have said, you know what? We need to keep slavery. Because it was basically, it's a part of that Mason-Dixon line, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so... Anyway, it's easy to armchair quarterback, but I honestly believe that they needed to slowly change the sentiments. And I believe that we saw the fruition. And so here's the question. If the Constitution was supportive of slavery, how was it that the institution of slavery became in such dire straits in the 18 teens? In other words, why was it necessary for the Missouri Compromise to come forward? The Missouri Compromise was clearly a violation of the Constitution, and the reason it came forward was because the fruition of the pruning away and the shedding of slavery in the Union was actually coming to fruition.
Mm-hmm.
You can't. I mean, the history proves this. The right. The actual outcome from what happened. It's not like it was speculation, right? I mean, it wasn't like, oh, okay, so they went ahead and got rid of slavery, and the Union didn't work, and so they, you know, we wandered in misbelief. They actually, you know, galvanized, pulled together, created the Union, and the what was stipulated or what was stated and articulated by Wilson in Pennsylvania and up in Massachusetts and so forth, that actually came to be because they said, hey, this Constitution is actually going to slowly, you know, chip away and slavery is going to dry up on the vine. That, you know,
so,
go ahead.
Right. So in other words, the people who wanted to keep slavery had to come up with something. And the Missouri Compromise turned out to be it.
That's right. Absolutely. So anybody that makes these assertions that all they're doing is they're trying to play on this paradigm that America is racist and so forth. Now, America had, you know, and they were given an institution that was terrible. Again, mm-hmm. we talked about this a couple shows ago, you know, when I was talking about, you know, my article for Why Counties Matter Most. We inherited a system that the monarchs of Britain gave us. Mm-hmm. It's the same problems that they gave us with the Indians. And so we actually, it was on our charge to do the right thing. And in ways and at times we did, and in ways at times, these are men. They're fallible. Fallible. Thank you.
Right.
And so what do we do? I think when it comes to the end, and this is, you got to be a godless person to basically say, you know, that there is no justice. There is justice. I think every single one of these people that did bad, that did wrong, and did harm to others and made others suffer, I think they'll all be held accountable.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there is a judgment. But for these people who are godless, there is no judgment other than theirs.
Right.
And how pretentious is that?
That's pretty bad.
Anyway, so, okay, so we're moving into Section 9, and we've got this, let's call it the ending of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
And this actually moved forward. So the next, and that right there was violated, right?
Yeah.
Because after they started shutting down the slave trade, the southern states actually tried to maintain, and they got pretty colorful in how they maintained the importation of slaves. What they did was they started, you know, bringing the slaves over into Latin America or down into the Portuguese and Spaniard ports, and then they would change ships to a American or a different type of flag, and then they would bring them up. So it was a whack-a-mole situation going on for the federal government to constantly trying to find how they were bringing these folks in.
So they managed to avoid even the taxation
by doing absolutely. Right. And so, in Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations, he talks about it's just inherent in man to try to reduce his burden.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, right? I mean, if you're
sure.
if you're carrying a load, you know, you're heading to the, you know, to the west, you got a wagon and everything else, and you realize that your load is just too heavy, your wagon's not going to make the trip, then what do? You throw stuff off the wagon. You go, okay, what is it we have to shed? It's the same thing if you all of a sudden you're carrying all this stuff on your back and you go, I'm not going to be able to make it up that hill. I got to shed some of this. And maybe you go back for it. You know, you get it back up, you know, they go back and get it all up on top of the hill and then you drag it down. Whatever. I mean, you have to work harder or you work less. You mm-hmm. have to make those choices. And 9 times out of 10, what do people do? Do they work harder?
Oh, my, no.
Oh, okay. There you go. Right. Okay. So the next line, go ahead and read that.
The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it.
Okay. So this is where they have the ability to do it if the public safety may require it, but it is something that they can't do. In other words, there has to be, and the problem here, folks, is that they didn't create a mechanism of what it would require. See, like in the Bill of Rights, Madison actually said, hey, you need to have a judge actually sign off on a warrant to basically inspect your property or to basically, you know, search through your things to see something. They can't just do that.
Well, that's the Fourth Amendment, right?
That is the Fourth Amendment. But here, there is no judge or there's no, you know, overseer to make sure that there's a real reason why public safety may require it.
Mm.
In other words, the state legislatures should probably be that, I'll just say that barrier, that little, you know, resistance from the federal government to being able to say, okay, hold on here, you're claiming that we, you know, don't have this required. I mean, it's one thing if you're in rebellion, the state legislature that's rebelling against, like in the Civil War, then okay, that's off the table. I mean,
right.
You know, the sure. Public safety is now at war. So, but when it comes to a harmonious, you know, when it's an invasion or something like that, then I think that the state legislature would have actually been more inclined to actually say, you know what, I think we need to do this at this point in time because of that. Anyway, I'm just thinking that there needs to be external checks on some of these things, and I think right there that was one of them because it was abused, and it was abused significantly, and it has been abused. As a matter of fact, Lincoln abused it. We know FDR abused it.
Mm-hmm. So real quick, there's a word here, a privilege. Why does it say the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus and not the right of the writ of habeas corpus? Any idea?
So,
And it probably goes into privileges and immunities, but I'm just wondering why if you see anything in this wording.
Well, so I think that it was even in England, you know, people talk about, you know, Blackstones, the rights and those types of things. Did that mean that the king stayed, did never cross those lines?
I would imagine he probably did.
Oh, he did cross those lines. Absolutely. And so, even though they were rights, it was also perceived as a privilege by government. Does that make sense?
No.
Now, is it an inalienable right? Is it an inalienable right for the writ of habeas corpus? Is that an inalienable right?
Yeah, maybe not. Okay. You have a right to life and liberty.
Life, liberty, and
property.
And but, you know, some of the things that we included to protect that was due process.
Right.
You can't be incarcerated, you know, and lose your liberty or life without due process.
Mm-hmm.
And so those types of things were incorporated. But, you know, when government had to arrest people because, hey, you're committing a crime, you had to have, before you could get arrested, something had to happen. A grand jury had to indict you if it's an infamous crime. And so insurrection would be an infamous crime.
Mm-hmm.
Treason would be an infamous crime. So a grand jury would have to indict you. So the writ of habeas corpus, that grand jury in times of necessity would be put aside, but that didn't necessarily take away your right to due process.
Okay.
It's the right to, you know, for their ability to arrest you without having, you know, an indictment and that whole process. But the, you know, if they're going to hold you, then, okay, now you have to have, you know, a speedy trial. Those other rights, you know, need to be afforded to you. This is only, taking away the ability to just basically swoop people up without indictments and then charge them. But the whole legal process on the back end should be happening. You still have a right to a speedy trial. You still have a right to due process.
Okay.
But the protection, and I kind of said this in an earlier show in the past week or so, that when you look at it, we the people are the superiors, and we're protected in every possible way. But the question is, does government at any point in time need to be expeditious in grabbing people that might be doing wrong, that they just don't have the time to convene a grand jury? And so they say right here, you know, during rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Okay.
Okay. So the no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed by the federal government. What is a bill of attainder?
Good question. I was about to ask you that. I think I could explain an ex post facto law, but what is a bill of attainder?
A bill of attainder is basically classifying a group of people, you know, like vaccinations. If you don't have vaccinations, then we're punishing you.
Hmm.
That would be a bill of attainder. So actually, a bill of attainder is usually a capital punishment where they kill people.
What?
If you really look it up, bills of attainder are where, and so in communist revolutions, they create bills of attainder. Anybody that's educated will be executed.
What?
Oh, yeah.
I don't think I ever heard it explained that way.
Okay, so Pol Pot in Cambodia, the killing fields, he took everybody that was educated after they seized power, and they basically initiated a bill of attainder where they went out and killed everybody. It happens all the time in communist revolutions. Now, we have a right and protection from bills of attainder, but it's not just limited to bills of attainder. When you look at this and when you actually go through the discussions of this, it includes bills of attainder and punishment.
Wow. So here's what it says. A bill of attainder is a piece of legislation that declares a party is guilty of a crime.
Yes. Yes.
Allow the government to punish a party for a perceived crime without first going through the trial process.
Yes. Right. So going straight into the punishment thereof. And in other words, you know, what they're doing with the vaccinations, oh, you've got to do this or we're punishing you.
Wow.
So do you see how that is a bill of attainder or bill of punishment? Now, wow. Technically, the attainder, if I remember correctly, is an execution. It's a capital punishment where they kill you. A bill of attainder or punishment, a bill of punishment is where they basically say, okay, you know, we require that everybody be vaccinated. And if you're not vaccinated, then, you know, we're going to come after you. And
we're going to take your rights.
You're going to, yeah, you can't travel. You can't be in public, blah, 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 blah. And
that was,
go ahead.
That was done rampantly. So in the last 3 years, we saw the bill of attainder, this provision violated on a rampant scale.
Right. Well, so this is, you got to remember, Section 9 applies to the federal government, that they cannot create bills of attainder or punishment,
mm-hmm.
nor can they create ex post facto laws. What's an ex post facto law?
This is where you make something. This is a law where you make something illegal after the fact. So let's say you create a law, but you want to prosecute people who were doing this before the law was created, correct?
Okay, so say it again. Say it maybe differently. Can you do that?
Okay.
Because I think you're right. I think you're right. Go ahead.
Okay. So
give me an example.
So you create a law in which it's enforced retroactively. So let's say an example. Let's say, okay. Let's suppose that it is legal to make. I'm. let's suppose it's legal to make whiskey, okay? To make your own. And then and people got stores of whiskey, and you make a law that says not only can you not make whiskey, but if you've been doing it, we're gonna come get you.
Okay, so
apparently I'm having an awkward time.
That's okay. So an ex post facto law is taking something that is legal and making it a crime and coming to now arrest you for doing something that was legal. Now, I'll give you a good case in point what an ex post facto law would be. It's like going into the forest and hunting and then making a law and saying that you can't do that.
Okay.
Or here's a better one that's really in direct relationship to today. You buy property that doesn't have any water on it, and at that point in time when you buy the property, your ability to put a well on that property exists. And you can go and hire somebody to actually, you know, drill a well for you, you know, however much that costs, that's at your expense, so that you have water on that property, so that that property becomes serviceable.
Okay.
Then, while you own that property, they pass a law that says you cannot put wells. If you do not have a well on that property, then you can no longer have a well. You know, in other words, you can't get a well on that property. Well, that basically just destroyed the value of that property. And they made it illegal when you bought that property with, you know, the legality, the, you know, you had this ability to do it. And then they created a law that basically says now you can't do it.
But you've already done it.
Well, you bought the property, but you hadn't put the well on. And now they say you can't have a well on that. And in other words, they basically made something that was purely legal when you actually bought it, and you have a right to that. See, it's another. So the only way they could actually institute no wells on property would be if you sold that property without a well, then the buyer cannot put a well on that property. In other words, you have to. You can't grandfather it back to people that already have property. You'd have to all new transactions. If the property doesn't have a well, then you can't put a well on it. But everybody that has property, that you know, since we passed this law, you can still get a well on your property.
Okay.
It's only when you transfer that title that that person is basically buying useless property.
Wow.
They can't make your property useless just because they want to control, you know, the water or what have you. That would be an ex post facto law.
Are we okay? That seems it probably should be simpler, but we've seen bill of attainder on a rampant form. Where have we seen ex post facto?
Well, we've actually seen the Western states and many of the states in the Union passing water restriction rights.
Okay.
Sure. And or other restriction rights, such as, you know, when they come along and say you can't have a chicken coop.
Okay.
Well, if you've owned that property and you had a chicken coop and they say you can't have one, they've instantly made you a criminal.
Right.
They can't do that.
Well, all right, here's another thing. In Utah, you're not allowed to collect rainwater. It's a crime. Okay? In Missouri, they encourage it.
So, yeah. And in a state that if you've created a system that would collect rainwater as a part of your property to actually create a little reservoir for water to be used later on, then what they basically did was they made that system illegal to operate. And they can't do that. That would be an ex post facto law. It's one thing to say, you know, if you have a system or you have the ability of, you know, capturing rainwater, that's okay. But moving forward, any property that doesn't have that system, you can't put that system on.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
All right. Sure.
Okay. Right. It's basically being able to change the rules of the game you know, in your property rights or what have you, mm-hmm. while, you know, you had these, again, property rights. You had the right access to the water, to this resources on the land. And they come out and say, oh, well, you can't do that anymore. They can't do that. The federal government can't do that.
Sure.
Okay. All right. So the next one is interesting because this actually creates a conflict with another one of the amendments. And actually, this deserves to be green. And I'm going to make it green.
Okay.
Because
no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken.
Right. Okay. So what that means is, in other words, income tax.
Okay.
So if you really read the 16th Amendment, that is a capitation.
Mm-hmm.
No capitation or direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein. So this basically, when you look at the 16th Amendment, let's jump down to the 16th Amendment.
Okay.
And that would be right there. So, no, that's the 6th Amendment. I need the 16th. There we go. Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. When I read the language of this, this really speaks more to Article 1 and not to Article 9.
Okay.
In other words, Article 9 is a restriction placed upon government that they can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at the language, I've got to pull the debates up because I think that this is another one of those problems that they created with the 16th Amendment that violates the Uniformity Clause and it violates this capitation.
Okay.
So anyway, so it just proves that when you create a constitutional amendment, that amendment cannot have any conflicts with other parts of the Constitution, or it's no good. It's a deficiency. It's a failure.
Okay.
Anyway, moving on. No duty or no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. No exportation tax, period.
Okay.
And so how are we doing on that? Because this is being violated.
So here's...
Well, Paul, if you didn't notice, I'm sorry, folks. I had no idea. I knew that we were coming up on time. I thought we had time for this one bullet, and obviously not. So we will have to pick this up tomorrow. But, I mean, as we go through these things, and this is very specifically Section 9, is all about restrictions on the federal government and what they can't do. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
Folks, I'm constantly providing you with case after case and giving you both the empirical information as well as irrefutable academic evidence that the federal government is operating well outside the bounds of the Constitution. In measuring outlays, the federal government is spending over 80% of your tax dollars on unconstitutional government. This is why we don't need a balanced budget amendment. We just need to enforce the Constitution. So what is it going to take for you to take a stand in getting the federal government back into the framework of the Constitution? To be clear, the solution is simple and does not require much work on any one individual, especially if everyone contributed to the effort. We only ask that you make a commitment today to contributing however you can and make the difference necessary for our posterity's sake. Send me an email at info@reclaimingtherepublic.org and let me know how you'd like to help so we can help you save our republic.